Good morning. All smiles. Wonderful, wonderful. As is our custom, we read the declaration before we begin. And if this is your first time visit, we recommend that you pick up the April, May, June copy, which is on the table as you enter. However, before we begin, the purpose of all this is to spread broadcast the teachings of Theosophy, as recorded in the writings of H.P.B., H.P. Blavatsky, and W.Q.J., William Q. Judge. These little documents contain in them our program for 3 months at a time, today being the 26th of March. Our topic today will be beginning the memories of the soul. Beginning. Now, we do have a study class every week on Wednesday from 7:30 to 8:30. Be it known that the doors of the lodge are open at 5:15 so that you may come in and familiarize yourself with the surroundings, especially in the library where you will find references and many wonderful books. There will be in there a volunteer, like ourselves, who will introduce you to the surroundings and what the topic will be for that particular evening. Now, it's my understanding that this Wednesday coming, the key to Theosophy, we will continue in, since we're working on that. That's a little book by H.P. Blavatsky, and it's the study class. And as I said, the doors open at 5:15 so that you can go to the library promptly. At 7:15, the library closes, allowing you 15 minutes before we begin the class from 7:30 to 8:30. And this Wednesday coming, the topic is the thinking principle. And these terms are plain. You have to think about them. It should be understood right from the beginning that volunteer means voluntary service. And on this, you'll see a little note. Being in sympathy with the purposes of this lodge, as set forth in the declaration, which you will shortly hear, I hereby record my desire to be enrolled as an associate. It being understood that such association calls for no obligation on my part other than that which I myself, and the word determination. For the policy of this lodge is independent devotion to the cause of Theosophy, without professing attachment to any theosophical organization. It's loyal to the great founders of the Theosophical movement, but does not concern itself with dissensions or differences of individual opinion. The work it has on hand and the end it keeps in view are too absorbing and too lofty to leave it to time or inclination to take part in side issues. That work and that end is the dissemination of the fundamental principles of the philosophy of Theosophy. Repeat, that work and that end is the dissemination of the fundamental principles of the philosophy of Theosophy, and the exemplification and practice of those principles to a truer realization of the self, a profounder conviction of universal brotherhood. It holds that the unassailable basis or union among theosophers, wherever and however situated, is similarity of aim and purpose in teaching. and therefore has neither constitution, bylaws, nor officers, the sole bond between its associates being that basis. And it aims to disseminate this idea among theosophists in the furtherance of unity. It regards as theosophists all who are engaged in the true service of humanity, without distinction of race or creed or sex or condition or organization, and it welcomes to its association all those who are in accord with its declared purpose and who desire to fit themselves by study and otherwise to be the better able to help and teach others. The true theosophist belongs to no cult or sect, yet belongs to each and all. And repeat, the April, May, June circular is all ready. And as you see, it has a few comments on the first page and on the inside page. So if it's the first time, at least you can take it with you and familiarize yourself with what you will find in these rooms. As is our custom, before we begin the topic for today, we have a reading for you from this little book called The Voice of the Silence. Wonderful little book. And most of us have a copy of it, and we keep it with us all the time. Fragment one. These instructions are for those ignorant of the dangers of the lower Iti. He who would hear the voice of Nada, the soundless sound, and comprehend it, he has to learn the nature of Dharana. Having become indifferent to objects of perception, the pupil must seek out the Raja of the senses. The thought producer, he who awakes illusion. The mind is the great slayer of the real. Let the disciple slay the slayer, for when to himself his form appears unreal, as do on awaking all the forms he sees in dreams, when he has ceased to hear the many, he may discern the one, the inner sound, which kills the outer. Then only, not till then, shall he forsake the region of prasad, the false, to come into the realm of Sat, the true. Before the soul can see, the harmony within must be attained and fleshly eyes be rendered blind to all illusion. Before the soul can hear the image, man has to become as deaf to roarings as to whispers, to cries of bellowing elephants, as to the silvery buzzing of the golden firefly. Before the soul can comprehend and may remember, she must unto the silent speaker be reunited. Just as the form to which the clay is modeled is first united with the potter's mind. But then the soul will hear and will remember, and then to the inner ear will speak the voice of the silence. Thank you.
Friends, our topic for the month of March has been mental progress, and this morning we are taking up our final consideration for this month, regaining the memories of the soul. So we thought we'd start with some comments on the significance of the title for our consideration this morning. First, it may occur to you that somehow there is a relationship between regaining the soul memory, or memories of the soul, and mental progress. And this may sound new to those who come with a common idea of what it means to regain soul memories. And that generally is that people who are interested in regaining memory of the soul are looking for the details of their previous lives, maybe what they've accomplished, what difficulties they may have had, to gain some insight into their lives, the way they find them now. But they're basically looking for a recollection or a remembrance of specific details of previous lives. And very often, the motivation here for gaining these soul memories is either connected with curiosity, well, that would be interesting to know and talk about, or for some personal benefit. And as we said, it could be a very sincere one, trying to work through some difficulty in this life. But our title seems to suggest, as we said, that regaining soul memories is a signpost of achievement in progress in this path of mental progress. So a very significant point there. And if we go to the Bhagavad Gita, one of the devotional books we study, we hear these opening words of Krishna to his disciple Arjuna: "Both I and thou have passed through many births, O harasser of thy foes. Mine are known unto me, but thou knowest not of thine." So it's apparent from that the regaining the memory of the details even of one's previous lives has been achieved by great souls, such as Krishna. We also have this statement that we heard read from the Voice of the Silence: "Before the soul can comprehend and may remember, she must unto the silent speaker be united." So, in other words, regaining memory of the soul is the result of an effort towards conscious union of the soul with the spirit. In other words, it's the result of mental progress. We also hear from Mr. Judge, whose writings on theosophy we study, "Achieving spiritual knowledge is but regaining the memory of the soul, since this true knowledge is, quote, impacted in the imperishable center of man's nature." So all, in that sense, spiritual learning for us, acquirement of spiritual knowledge, is but a regaining of the memory of something that is already present within us, and yet for the time being, as far as we know, inaccessible. The second point to be considered as we hear this title, notice that the title is not to gain the memories of the soul. It is to regain the memories of the soul. And that little two letters has a significance, because what it tells us is that human beings must have had these memories at one time, but lost them, and now have to regain them again. And in the philosophy, we hear certain doctrines taught that every human being has certain times in the course of their life cycle when they do regain the memories of the soul that they had previously lost. And one of those times is the review of the experiences of the life just lived that occurs just after the death of the body. And for most human beings, the details of all these experiences are lost to our subconscious mind, but they are recorded there. And at the death of the body, when the heart is stopped and the brain is beginning to cease to function, all those memories come before the soul, and there's a recollection of all those minuscule events, and that has a definite purpose. There's also another time when all souls, human beings, have a remembrance or a regaining of the memories of the soul, and that is in the preview of the life to come, just before our rebirth into a new body. And at that state, there is a remembrance of the soul of all the details and conditions and karma of previous lives from that high perspective of knowledge, and the recognition that the life to come is fair and just, and the soul takes it up willingly with an understanding of its purpose in life in general. But then as it does incarnate and once again comes into a new body, a new brain, a new personality, a veil comes over, and for most people, those memories are forgotten, but not for all. There are hundreds and hundreds of verified documented cases now of children who have a clear recollection of the details of a preceding life. And one such Dr. Ian Stevenson, a psychiatrist who had been connected with the University of Virginia Medical School, has written many articles and books on this subject. And of course, there are a number of other books on that. The other time when all human beings seem to have this period of recollection is every night we go through what's called the deep sleep state. And on that stage, the soul is freed from the limitations of the brain and body, and has experiences of soul wisdom and remembrances of all its experience. The problem is, as it comes back into the body, into the waking state, and under the influence, very often that's forgotten. Although portions of it do come through in the allegories of dreams, as well as little intimations of that experience we might get through the day. So the point here is we all go through it. We all have common experiences where we can regain the memory of the soul. But what we're talking about today is a conscious effort, things we can do to be more aware of those soul memories while we're in a waking state. And in order to do this, we come to the third aspect of this title, and that is that there are three kinds of memory that are related here, which have to do with our subject. And the first one we're very familiar with, this is recollection, where you're trying to recall where you were born, what you may have ate yesterday, where you live. It's a conscious effort to recall details, and it's very much dependent on the functioning of the brain. And for most of us, we generally do not remember the details of a previous life, or as we said, some do. And then there's a second kind of memory, which is called associative memory, and this is also very much dependent on the brain. And this is where you come into a room and you hear a song, or somebody says something, or there's a certain smell, and it brings to recollection a very pleasant memory you had in a previous time of your life, in previous years, and maybe you remember things you did as a child or a teenager that you thought you'd forgotten, and they come to life again. And of course, we have the opposite end of the spectrum, where certain people have been through traumatic experiences, and a common everyday sound that may not affect you or me sort of causes them to relive and re-experience those traumatic experience and those memories from the past, as if they are going through them. So that's what we're speaking of, associative memory. But the final kind of memory, or what we're going to talk about today as soul memory, is the memory which is a synthesis of all the past experiences that we've been through. It's the culminated wisdom of all our experience. And the best term we can come up for it that we might understand is reminiscence. And this is the kind of memory where we're not necessarily looking for the conscious recall of ideas, but it's the synthesis of that experience. So we don't necessarily remember all the math drills of the tables we did when we were younger, but we know now we have these synthesis of all that knowledge. So when we go to a restaurant or we go to the store, if we're still counting change and not using our computers and cell phones and all that to figure it out for us, we know how to do that. Or if we get on a bike, maybe we haven't ridden a bike for years, we can pick it up. There's a reminiscence there. But that kind of memory, the synthesis of all our experience, which is the sum total of all the details, is what we call reminiscence of and soul memory. So that's what we're talking about today. Regaining the accumulated wisdom of everything we've been through. And it's going to come through to us. We'll know we're making some progress in that area in a few ways. We'll see it in our character. We'll see it in our conscience. And we'll see it in our improving what we'll call spiritual discernment and discrimination about what is real and what is not real. So now we get into the part where we're going to look at how we can apply theosophical doctrines to this subject. And interesting, we need to remember these doctrines if we are going to make mental progress and regain the memories of the soul. So not only is soul memory the result of mental progress, but soul memory, or the ability to remember spiritual ideas and truths, is necessary to our mental progress and recovering more soul memory. So we are given certain ideas that we might say rearrange the mental furniture we carry in our minds and place our minds to be more in a line in tune with these memories so that they can come through easier. So these three fundamental propositions are said to be self-evident. They're not ideas which we need to accept on the authority of any other human being or what it's taught in a book. We can listen to these, we can check, test, and verify them through our own reason and judgment and experience. But most importantly, they have the ability to resonate with the memories in our soul and awaken within us those memories that confirm these doctrines to be true. It's like you have a tuning fork, and you strike the tuning fork and it gives a certain tone vibration, and then you hold it to a glass and now the glass begins to vibrate, resonate, and produce the same tone as the tuning fork. So hearing these ideas sort of resonates with those ideas that have already been impacted in the spiritual core of our being, and they come through, and through our own intuition, reason, judgment, we know them to be self-evident. So the first idea is deity. We're not going to go into this in extensive detail, but just basically the idea that the source of life is one eternal, infinite principle or reality. And because everything comes from, is sustained and united by this one eternal source, there is a unity of life and being spiritually, physically, and mentally. So our mental unity might be that all beings having spirit as their essential nature, are conscious, intelligent, and have a memory of some degree according to their own nature. So all beings are alive, conscious, intelligent in some degree, and have memory. And they all are united spiritually because, as said, in our spiritual center, we are of that same essence as deity, and therefore all interconnected on those inner planes. And of course, we are interdependent physically. Our physical lives and circumstances interact, and no one can do anything without having an effect on all of others, and the actions of others cannot help but have some type of influence on us. That's not to say we cannot determine that influence by the exercise of our judgment and free will, but we feel, because of our physical natures and interdependence, the actions of others. The second idea we want to carry with us is this idea of law as a universal process in nature. And the basic law that we see throughout the universe is the law of cycles or periodicity, or the return of that which was before. And one of those aspects is the return of previous impressions. And memory, then, in this context, is but the experience of the effect of the cyclic return of previous impressions under certain conditions which cause them to be remembered. So we experience something, it leads an impression, and it's always there, and it will return again in a cycle, with a memory, if we place ourselves in certain conditions. So we know that at certain times of year, depending on the conditions of the year and the events, certain memories and feelings come back to us associated with that. And we can use that law of the cyclic return of impression to our advantage as well. And we can get into that in our group discussion afterwards. But then there's also this idea of reincarnation, the idea that as thinkers, souls, if you will, we incarnate life after life in a different personality, in a different race or nation, with a different body and a different brain, and it's not haphazard or due to chance, but is always the lawful result or karma of the causes we've set up in the past, or will be the lawful result and karma of the causes that we are setting up now and will reap in the future. So as it says, as a man sows, so shall he reap. And as said before, the soul carries these impressions from life to life, and they come through for all of us as our character, our conscience, that inner feeling, as we gotta be careful here, this is something we need to stay away from, and our discernment, our judgment. But we can, as we said, do things and develop ourselves that improve those faculties. The third idea we can bring from the philosophy to this consideration is that of evolution. Regaining soul memories will require for the human being self-induced and self-devised effort. Everything that a human being achieves is through self-induced and self-devised effort. There are no special gifts or privileges. But what we achieve through the effort put out is always checked by our previous karma. In other words, the effects that have been set in motion by previous things we've done. So regaining soul memory is not something that's going to occur over the weekend if you take a course or if you pick up a book. The kind of soul memory we're talking about, the regaining of the synthesis of our previous wisdom through many lives, will require patience, because the obstructions that have been set up through the influence of our past karma affect our current body and mind. And those obstructing conditions in our body and mind and brain have to be removed and replaced with other conditions that are favorable to the reception of this wisdom. So as Judge says in the ocean, the brain has to be made porous to the influence or the dictates of the soul. And one of the ways the soul tries to dictate or influence our everyday ways is through this, through the brain and through our conscious recognition of things. So when we're using the term soul, remember that theosophy teaches that we are souls who are using a body in this life. We are not bodies that have a soul, but rather we are souls that have fashioned and are using the body as an instrument in this life. Now, there are many other aspects of the philosophy. This is a huge subject. We can bring out some of it in our discussion. It relates to the sevenfold nature of man, the different aspects of higher and lower aspects of our mind, the various characteristics of the mind, its tendencies, and how we can begin to discipline, how the higher mind can begin to take control of the lower mind. And rather than going into it now, as your questions or comments come up, we can then go into those, some of those ideas. Yeah. Well, we're not ready yet for questions. We'll take it in a minute. So, keep thinking of it, though. Don't forget it. Okay. But we just want to lay it out that there's a lot the philosophy can say that we could cover, but we just wanted to cover those three fundamental principles to get the base going. So, now we come to what we are the main points of what path can we use to regain this soul wisdom? Now, in certain traditions in the East, this is called Raj Yoga, or the highest yoga, or union. And this is the method that we see propounded in the Bhagavad Gita, in Patanjali's yoga aphorisms, and it is also the method that we've heard described in the Voice of the Silence. And if you read those first three pages that we had read this morning, you will see the outline of the path to regaining soul memory there, because everything else that follows in the book is but a commentary or an expression of the some of the details involved. So we see from those three pages that there are four pillars on this path, or four means by which we can accomplish it. The first one is we need to begin to practice some degree of concentration in one-pointedness. And this is because the mind has the tendency to jump from one thing to another. It'll jump from unpleasant memories to pleasant memories. And, you know, if you really want to remember something, you got to keep your mind one-pointed. How many times have we walked into a room and we forgot what we came there for? Or somebody asked it what time it was and we looked at our watch, and a few minutes later, we forgot what time it was. We have to look again. So it's because our minds have become too scattered, and we need to practice a one-pointedness of bringing it back to the consideration at hand. And as the devotional book says, as we develop this practice of concentration or one-pointedness, we want to begin to place it on meditation. And meditation here means the turning of our thought, our awareness, to spiritual truths, truths that relate to ideas that are eternal, not changing, not depending on particular time, place, or person, but are universal ideas. And we've had some of those presented this morning. But we need to begin to align our thought so it resonates with the thought of our soul or the memories of our soul. Because remember, in our soul are stored the accumulated spiritual memories or lessons of all the experiences of our previous lives. We might say the highest aroma, the fruit, the blossom of all our experience worthy of our spiritual nature is stored there. And that is what we are trying to get a hold of. So if we want to get that, we need to begin to train this lower mind through concentration and meditation. The second thing we need to do is we need to develop a higher indifference to the objects of perception by the senses without disregarding them. Because we know we need our senses. If we don't have the operation of our senses, we're in trouble. We're in danger. So in a certain sense, they are important. They can't be disregarded. But we have to develop a higher indifference to them. Well, what does that mean? Well, normally indifference means we just don't care, or we're lazy. We won't make the effort. But the higher indifference here means that we are experiencing the information that we are getting through the senses, but we are not swayed off our mental base. We are not influenced. We are not raised to pitches of extreme fantasy and euphoria and happiness when something good occurs, nor are we cast into the deepest despair and doubts and anger when something unpleasant we experience. So it's sort of like a mental balance so that we are indifferent. We can maintain our balance mentally despite what comes through us through the senses. And this is described in the Bhagavad Gita, where Krishna says that he who has an inclination to the senses in them has a concern, and from this concern is created passion, and from this passion is created anger, and from anger comes loss of memory, and from loss of memory comes loss of discrimination, and then loss of all. So we see that it all begins with learning to gain control of the senses. And this is done through the practice of detachment. And very often, very simply, it says, it is, whenever you experience something through the senses or through your daily experience, you remind yourself that you are the witness or the experiencer of it, but you are not that. So you taste, as an older student used to say, you have a bite of chocolate cake. And it's delicious, and it smells good, and it tastes good. But rather than getting so emotionally wrapped up in the experience and the craving of it, one stands back and mentally and reminds themselves that I'm experiencing this, but I am not that. Because anything that I experience through the senses, through the feelings, comes and goes, is changeable, here today, gone tomorrow. But I am that witness, that perceiver, which is changeless and endures throughout all experience. And what we begin to do that is make a distinction in our mind between ourselves as experiencers and the experiences we go through. That frees us from the influence of the senses and impassions and allows us to turn our minds to other things without being distracted. Because anyone who's tried to concentrate or meditate or pursue anything knows that it is the memory of all these passions and experiences and things we need to do that gets us off track. So sometimes you can't get something done through during the day because you wanted to do something, but at the end of the day you forgot to do it because all these other things came up and took over your memory, and by the time the end of the day comes, you didn't get it done because you did too many other things. So it's the same idea but carried to the realm of mental practice. So we're always bringing this disciplining of the lower mind, bringing it back to a consideration of these truths and of the unity. When we ever see our thought and our feeling, our emotions drifting off to something that seems to be based on separateness, an idea that comes to us through the senses, we bring it back to thought and feeling based on the unity of life. And when we do that, we come to the fourth pillar or means, and that is the path of love, compassion, and altruistic service. That it is not just through mental discipline, but we might also say heart discipline, the heart doctrine. He who lives the life will know the teachings. And he who lives the life will find soul wisdom, soul memory spontaneously springing up in the course of time. And so this is where we come to realize that as souls, we are constantly in the midst of other souls who are struggling and often failing in this path of mental progress. But nevertheless, they are moving to the goal. And so it reminds us to be compassionate, patient, tolerant for our own failures as well as those of others. So we'll stop here and leave you time to ask questions, make comments on this huge and fascinating subject. Now, yes.
Okay. So if we're given a preview of the life to be lived, how much detail do we get? And then we forget it. So wouldn't it be better if we could remember some of it? Wouldn't we make wiser choices if we could recover some of that memory? Because just speaking for myself, going blindly through many phases of life, you don't really know what's coming.
Mm-hmm. By the question refers to the preview of the life to come just before incarnation. And as it says, the soul at that point has a spiritual experience in which it is aware of all its knowledge and experience from all previous lives and sees that its karmic actions in the past are leading it to a certain incarnation in a certain nation, race, family, a certain station, and that it is all just, it is all under law, and takes it up willingly. Now, it is, and about then, once we incarnate, we forget that knowledge, and maybe it'll be years before we reawaken, and it usually comes to us at some point in their lives and with the inner voice that tells us there's got to be more to life than this running around all the time and this physical wheel. There's got to be more to myself. There's got to be more purpose I have. Why am I here? What am I doing? What am I going to accomplish? And one begins to search until they find that source that seems to resonate, that seems to empathize or sympathize with what they already know to be true. And they once again take up the old path and have a feeling that this is, now I know what I'm supposed to do in my life. They find it. And usually it's through the awakening in the mind that it comes through. So it would be to our advantage to do that, but for some of us we can't. We don't consciously make that effort. And here is where suffering becomes our best friend, something we don't want to necessarily hear, but it is through pain and suffering that we are wakened up, we are awoken to consider these things which we might not consider if our life was going smooth all the time and we were getting everything we want. Yes, here.
Yeah. Within the soul remembering, is there any talk about the concept of a new soul? One that enters in and experiences and their memories within this life, and rather than, just the idea, the concept of a new soul entering into without that past karmic experience.
So when you say a new soul, are you speaking of a soul that was created new for the first time, never having previously existed?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, this comes from, at least from one tradition, that of the Christian theological condition, which teaches that each soul is created anew by the divine, the deity, and is new and fresh and no previous existence or memories for that life. And not only is it created new out of nothing, but it will continue to exist for an eternity in the future. So that is a specific theological doctrine, which is not what is taught in theosophy. And it was because of that doctrine propounded by the church in its early centuries that at the Council of Constantinople, they actually made the doctrine of reincarnation or preexistence anathema, which it had been taught by Origen and a number of the church fathers. But in order for there to be reincarnation, there had to be a soul that previously existed for many lives. And of course, once you take away that idea, you basically take away the idea of reincarnation.
How does theosophy deal with that concept? I mean, I know Blavatsky, in her work, she talks a lot about Christian ideology and goes into it. So how is that part of...
Well, theosophy would point to our own, would give a certain teaching, but it would also point to our logic and experience. And that is that from our own experience, anything that has a beginning has to have an ending. And there's a beginnings and endings to all manifesting things. That's our experience. And also, when we think of the idea of eternity, we can't think of anything that would exist eternally in the past that didn't also exist, eternally in the present that didn't also exist eternally in the past. So this whole idea of creating something anew, like a soul, which is an eternal being that didn't exist, it just doesn't make sense to our logic and experience. So theosophy would reject that particular doctrine, but also point to the fact that within the Christian tradition, even going back to the Old Testament, New Testament, and so-called teachings that we have of Jesus, what he says does not contradict the idea of reincarnation and the previous existence of the soul. We have the whole idea of John the Baptist coming back, who was Elijah of old, and the disciples asking Jesus if a man born blind was born blind because of something that he had done in the past, or was it something that his family did or whatever? What was the reason for it? So there was an acknowledgement there, an awareness of this idea of preexistence of the soul. Yes?
Dr. Stevenson in the University of Virginia was mentioned, and it was said that he wrote a lot of articles and some books on children who have very definite remembrances of reincarnation. And the question is, this Dr. Stevenson, was he standing back as a scientist observing and documenting what these children were saying, or was he using some kind of New Age psychic practice to regress them and cause them to remember past lives?
Mm-hmm. Well, there are... therapists these days who do use various types of regressions to, as they say, try to help people remember their past lives. But that is not what Dr. Stevenson did. He approached it from a very scientific approach, as any scientist would, where he elicited the stories, but then went back and painstakingly checked, tested, and verified the accuracy and validity of all these stories with any surviving relatives or records or anything that could confirm what this person said was true. And no case was selected as proof of reincarnation or memory of a past life by him unless it could be verified. So it wouldn't be a case where somebody, we know we have the stories of Bridie Murphy and also stories of children that have tremendous detailed memory of previous experiences. One of a child who remembered them being a pilot during World War II and the extensive documentation that went in to try to prove that. So that's the kind of work he did, and such that his work was accepted into scientific journals. Yes, here.
Okay.
No, yes.
Okay. So I don't think that the soul, completely forgets a lot. And I think one of the reasons, or one of the quote unquote proofs that you may see is, as a person, you may gravitate towards certain people or gravitate from certain people or certain situations based on these experiences that you've had with these people and places in your previous lifetimes. And some of the talents you may have that you just naturally acquire with no training or anything like that, you may have acquired them in previous lifetimes. So I think that's, you know. Mm-hmm.
Yes, the soul itself doesn't completely forget. As a matter of fact, it does remember. That's why we're saying regaining the memories of the soul, because once the soul incarnates, it becomes dual. The mind incarnates, it becomes dual. And this lower mind, which is very much using and influenced by the brain, does forget or needs to be reawakened and regain that knowledge. But even so, as suggested by the contributor, it comes through in warnings, it comes through in dreams, it comes through in talents, it comes through in aversions and sympathies, it comes through in genius, it comes through in intuition. So many ways, it comes through in our character. Good, bad, or indifferent. So many ways in which the accumulated wisdom of the soul comes through. The point is, do we recognize it as such, and do we know how to increase the availability of that spiritual knowledge, to regain more of it? Right now, we seem to have just a sliver of the tip of the iceberg, and we want to get more of that iceberg available to us. Yes?
We've heard the term out of focus. It appears that these teachings are teaching us how to adjust our ability to see. If you have a microscope, it opens up new worlds, a telescope that we didn't even know existed before. So could you explain the terminology used in these teachings that points out the way that focus your mind and pay attention? Okay.
Well, we sort of talked about these ideas that the mind, or the lower mind, is like an instrument or a tool that the soul, the thinker, the perceiver uses. And it can get out of dust, out of focus, or like a mirror can gather dust while it reflects. So it needs to be cleaned off and refocused. And we do this in a number of ways. As one said, one way is through practice of concentration, one-pointedness, not allow our minds to be scattered and drift off, but to train it to stay on the task at hand. And it can be a mundane task. It can be a task we're performing in our everyday work, but it's a discipline. And then we can always also carry that to the process of meditation, where the mind takes up a spiritual idea and reflects and considers that for as long as necessary. There is also the readjustment and refining that comes through the cleaning process, where we make ourselves indifferent to these experiences of the senses, which tend to lead us to draw the idea that we are separate from another, that we can somehow do things and get away from the consequences, that we can make effort, or others can make effort, and there's no just reward from it, or the world seems unjust to us. So there's all these ways in which we become indifferent to the senses. We talked about the detachment, which is drawing back and identifying. It's sort of a shaving process, which is described in the Upanishads, where the soul recognizes that all that is real is that which is unchanging. So we are not our bodies, we are not our minds, we are not our thoughts, we are not our feelings, we are not our senses. We experience those, but they are all unreal in the extent they are all changing. Whereas what remains the one reality is ourselves as the spiritual witness and the observer. And so all these things, all these terms, we can all begin to use in a daily way to regain the memory or the wisdom from the past. In the introduction, the student said that the devotional books are something we carry with us every day because we all need constant reminding of these spiritual truths, because there is the tendency to forget. We spoke of the Bhagavad Gita, 18 chapters in the middle of the Mahabharata, in the war between the Kurus and the Pandus, and Krishna's there on the battlefield with Arjuna, and the arrows are flying back and forth, and he's teaching him the highest ethics and spiritual philosophy. And as after that, Arjuna goes on to fight the battle and wins the day, but not soon after, he sits down with Krishna in the palace. He says, you know, that was wonderful what you taught me, but I've forgotten it. Can you tell me again? So that's like our souls. We constantly need reminding, either by the so-called saviors of the world or instructors that come back from time to time, or our own efforts to surround ourselves with books and companions and ideas that resonate, that seem to awaken and resonate with our own highest leanings. Yes?
Well, in terms of that, what you seem to be saying is that you read from the Voice of the Silence at the beginning, to begin this talk, and then we've been referencing the Bhagavad Gita. Now, we know that they're only little small books, but is it meditation, taking that book and carrying it with you, and in spare moments of the day, looking at it and filling your mind with the ideas that are presented there, mm-hmm. and you know, then go about your business. But,
right.
You know, we lead such hectic lives. Would something like that be able to, become single-minded?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's not, the contribution here has to do with the meditation that comes from devotional books. And we spoke of the tendency of the soul to have that recollection at the end of the death, at the death of the body, the end of its life cycle, and just before the beginning in the preview. We sort of emulate or can copy that in the times of set times of meditation at the beginning of our day and at the end of the day, where we try to recall these ideas and set them either as seeds by which we will live throughout the coming day, or as a way of accumulating and understanding the experience that we've had through the day. So there is that daily and set meditation that we can do, where we try to remember our lives in the context of these highest ideals and ideas. But as pointed out, there is always also the daily meditation. We all have a flow of meditation in our minds all the time. We think of ourselves as teachers, as family members, as workers, as belonging to this faith or that creed. We all have this stream of identity or awareness by which we identify ourselves, this flow of thought. That's a life's meditation. And we can daily begin to raise that up, be better parents, be better teachers, be better devotees, be better co-workers through the consideration of these ideas. Bringing our mind continuously to them. And the devotional books is one way. And of course, that's why we keep these rooms open week after week, year after year, on a regular basis, to give ourselves the mutual opportunity of sharing these ideas, reaffirming them, and finding ways to practically use them in our lives. So, next week, we start a new month with a new series of talks for the month of April, Nature's Symbols of Human Evolution. Promises to be a very interesting month of Sunday talks. And on Wednesday, taking up the Key to Theosophy, continuing on the subject of the nature of the thinking principle. Our meeting's adjourned.